Blog Talk Radio.
Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just for me has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach. Always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I am married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell. So you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself? I got an interesting email.
We get lots of interesting emails. Hi there, I'm Carol the Coach, and I am so happy to be with you tonight. You know, this is a show about sexual addiction. You know, it is the show that teaches you from the experts in the field where you need to go, what you need to do, what you need to read, and just keeps you abreast of all the information that's out there in this field, because this is an up-and-coming field. I say we're all pioneers. Only been in existence, really, for about 30 years, and although sexual addiction has always been in our history, we really haven't had information to study and the therapists who do know what they're doing. And so I encourage you, if you're thinking about your compulsive sexual behavior, or if you love somebody who seems to have compulsive sexual behavior, it's absolutely imperative you go to a specialist. And that specialist is a CSAT. And what you do is go to sexhelp.com, look for a provider, you put in your zip code, and it gives you the provider that's closest in your area. If there's nobody in your area, then look for providers that will do Skype. You know, I won't do therapy via Skype yet, but what I will do is I will consult. I'll help you with the recovery tasks. I'll go through the book with you. I'll get you on the right track. We'll get you to the right resources until you can find additional resources to manage your sexual addiction and, of course, take your life to the next level. Because when you get recovered, when you are constantly working on this situation, when you're doing the work, pays off, and it makes you a better person than you would have been if you hadn't had the addiction. Now, I know that if you have this addiction, you've probably hurt lots and lots of people. There's no doubt about it. And there may be some irreparable damage that you can never fix. But I promise you that we'll help you with the tools to make you a better person. And you will end up letting go of the shame and much of the pain and helping others. And it'll be a full circle event. That doesn't happen overnight. I wish it did, but it doesn't. It takes months and years to do the work. But I don't want to discourage you, because anything you want to do well. They've done the research, and it takes at least 10,000 hours to do that. And so, hey, I want to treat clients with sexual addiction. I better get my 10,000 hours of treatment in. If I want to have a beautifully muscular and fit body, I better put in 10,000 exercise hours in. And if you want to get some good, healthy recovery and be the person you want to be, you're going to have to put in the time. But as the 12-step program says, it's only one day at a time. So don't worry about the long term. Just say, what can I do today? What can I do today to make a difference? And you know, if you've listened to this show before, I'm a big proponent of if you tackle 8 out of the 10 recovery tools a day, you're well on your way to true recovery. Now, we interview a lot of experts in the field, and that's what I think is so amazing about this show. And a lot of times, I will be watching on our listserv for up-and-coming people who really are dedicated to their profession. And that's what I found with Ruby B. Johnson. You know, Ruby is a CSAT, and she got her bachelor's of social work in 2003 from Texas Women's University and her master's in 2005 from the University of Texas at Arlington. And since 2003, Ruby's roles have included clinical practitioner, community and professional development educator, and graduate and undergraduate adjunct professor. And I could tell she was a true teacher. She had a lot of stuff to talk to us about on the listserv. You know, in private practice, her areas of expertise are substance use disorders, sex addiction, intimacy and love addiction. I mean, this woman is absolutely studying so many of the things that I, too, am studying. She is teaching. She's teaching about these kinds of situations. She talks about multicultural families and couples, polyamorous and non-monogamous families and couples. She works with bisexual, gay, transgendered, and all sorts of diversity that not only does she want to assist in helping, she wants to advocate for. So I asked her to come on the show because she strives to be aware, knowledgeable, and skilled with everybody that she serves. And so tonight we're going to be talking about African-American culture and in actuality, the disservice many of us clinicians do because we don't have the knowledge base to do the work properly. You know, I'm all about learning and I'm all about educating both myself, the clinicians that listen to the show, and the addicts, partners, and loved ones out there. So I'm looking forward to talking with her. And, you know, I typically share in lots of different ways things that have happened to me during the week, people that I've worked with, goals that many of the people have wanted to work on. And so tonight, as I was working with some sex addicts, I asked them very poignantly, I said, you know, there was one thing that would tweak your recovery program, what would that be? And I got so many different answers today. I got, more often than not, I would make more calls to other sex addicts. Now, here's what I believe. You know, when I do groups, what I know to be true is that what happens inside the group happens outside of the group. And what that means is if something occurs in the group that shows insight, that teaches a skill somebody didn't have, they will practice that outside of the group, whether it be with other sex addicts, with their loved ones, you know, even with themselves, because so much of the work I do is helping sex addicts and partners to improve their self-care. So what I clearly heard from the majority of addicts that I interviewed today, that they need to make more calls. You know, so oftentimes sex addicts are really isolationists. They don't get out there and create healthy relationships. Instead, they isolate and they try to do everything by themselves. And that just doesn't work. It is exhausting. What I know to be true is that we're never as good as we potentially could be in terms of our recovery, in terms of our treatment, in terms of our education, if in actuality we're doing it all by ourselves. There is knowledge in groups. There is knowledge in calling people and hearing what they're dealing with. And so, again, I can't emphasize enough how important it is for addicts and for partners to call other people in the same situation. And the second thing that I consistently heard from my addicts today is that they would take better care of themselves and practice what they call good self-care. And that is that delicate balance between paying attention to their needs and paying attention to the needs of others. You know, oftentimes in my group, I will hear men that say, they'll say, you know, I just felt like things weren't fair at home. I'm doing much, much better. And yet my wife is still complaining. She's still seeing the negative. She's still being paranoid. She's still being suspicious. When they talk to their sponsors will remind them, you know what? This is not all about you. This really is about the other person. And you've heard me say before, it is an addict's job to reassure the capital R, their partners, that they've got their backs, that they're doing things differently, and that they are valuing their family in a new and different way. Now, that's not codependent. That is a new focus of interest, and I cannot emphasize that enough. Now, if you are somebody who has felt wounded, perhaps you had a very tough childhood, or perhaps, you know, you're a partner that just feels like you are not getting what you deserve in life. And I say, you know, it's time for you to really look at, instead of post-traumatic stress, post-traumatic growth. And post-traumatic growth is the ways that you've grown, how you've gotten stronger and healthier, how you are different and improved. And I'm telling you, you cannot go through this illness. You cannot love somebody with this illness, not have opportunities for lots and lots and lots of growth. And so it is time for people to take themselves out of that triangle of victim, rescuer, or perpetrator, and put themselves in the middle of empowerment. And when you do, you're much better able to take care of yourself, your family, learn your boundaries, and feel good about your decisions. So I hope that gives you some strength and recovery. And if you want to learn more about post-traumatic growth, just Google it. There's some great TED Talks on it. And I hope to be talking more about it in the future. If there's something that you want to know about, you have a special situation and you don't know where to turn, feel free to email me at carolthecoach@aol.com. And, you know, what I always say is, hey, I will work hard at finding the answers for you if I don't know them myself. I will work hard at finding resources for you. I can't say that I always have, but I sure have tried. It is my mission in life to serve you, because I think you are a population that deserves that. Whether you be the addict, whether you be the partner, or whether you be another loved one who has had experience and has felt wounded by your experience. No, I want to help. I want to make things better. And I really believe in doing that. So carolthecoach@aol.com, or go to my website, Sex Help with Carol the Coach. Many of you know I'm the only certified sexual addictions therapist in Indianapolis. If that isn't pitiful, I don't know what is. There are many communities that have 3, 4, 5, 6, 16, 26, 36 CSATs. Not good old Indianapolis. So right now, I am the one and only, and actually, I am the one and only when it comes to sexual addiction radio shows. Oh yeah, there's radio shows via iTunes, focuses on sex, and we'll have an occasional show on sexual addiction. This show is geared for sexual addiction first and foremost, always. And so we just are so thrilled to be having the experts in the field. You get to hear their voice. You get to hear about their new books that are coming out. And you get to decide what you're going to take and what you're going to leave. You know, it's that old adage about take what you want and leave the rest. If you don't necessarily agree with somebody, that's fine too. Or if you're like me, sometimes I have to hear it one, two, or three times before I really get the information. When I do, I promise you, I use it to the fullest. And I am very devoted to helping you all. And that's why I do this show every Monday night from 9 to 10 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. And that's why I do a blog for the Meadows. And you can catch those as well as other podcasts. You know, if you just want life skills, if you just want to learn how to assert yourself or how to handle conflict better, how to improve your self-esteem, and you want it to be different than sexual addiction, for many of my partners, you might be interested in this, go to blogtalkradio.com/Carol the Coach and look for the show Your Best Life. You can also get that on iTunes, and I have over 65 shows there that talk about life skills that are important in making you the best person possible. And hey, that's what we all want to do. Now, if you're listening to this show tonight and you have a question, you can feel free to call 646-595-3284. Again, that's 646-595-3284. And I will be happy to answer your calls. This is a radio call-in show, but what I know to be true is that it can feel very scary to call in. Everybody's afraid that somebody else will recognize their voice. Now, I tell all my addicts, I say, get to a meeting, and they go, I don't want to run into anybody that I know. And I say, hey, if they're in that group, they got the same issues too. You don't have to worry about your anonymity. So I just highly recommend those tools that I just talked about. And this show is all about enlightening and empowering you in the best ways possible. And tonight, as I indicated earlier, we have an expert in the field. So, Ruby Johnson, welcome to Sex Help with Carol the Coach. How are you?
I'm well. How are you doing, Carol?
Well, I am fine, and I am so thrilled to be having you on the show tonight because you really lend yourself to an expertise that, you know, probably we need to know more about. So I was really impressed with what you had to say on our listserv, and that's why I said, I want to interview Ruby and find out more about what we can do in this field to assist in cultural diversity and specifically the African-American population. It sounds like we've got a lot to learn. So share a little bit about your history and your goals and hopes for sexual addiction in the cultural diverse population.
Okay. Well, let's see. I have been in mental health for about 14 years. I primarily have been working in facility-based services on an inpatient level, partial hospitalization, intensive outpatient. And as a result of working in the field and working in addictions, I have found that a lot of the modalities that we use to intervene with our groups, including, I mean, just all groups across the board, at some levels it has been a one-size-fit-all with the 12-step model. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. when we bring that particular model into the field and do not couple it with anything else that considers some of the social, historical, political aspects of the individual, the person, I think that we miss the boat on many levels. So for me, as a result of becoming more specialized with working in the sex addiction field, I have found that even in this specialized field, there is still a need to consider other aspects of the person outside of just looking at the disease itself. And it's because I believe that there's other areas that impact the disease cycle, the addiction cycle. And mm-hmm. so my ultimate goal is to kind of put a spotlight on that or put a microscope on it so that within the Black community, which is what I have, I mean, a huge piece of my practice, I say about 50% of my practice are African Americans, and not just African Americans, Africans. And so I am having to pull from other areas where my specialization does not meet those particular needs. So my ultimate goal is to, you know, lend to the research, lend to the contribution within the community of highlighting the needs of African Americans.
Well, tell us, because obviously my listening audience tends to be addicts and then their partners from all different cultural diversity, and then also clinicians. So tell us a little bit about what you would want us to know so that if we're clinicians, we can treat differently and be more appropriate. And if we've got addicts and their partners and they're African or Black or African American, they can feel like they know what they're looking for in a clinician.
I'll start with the addict, the one who is seeking treatment. I believe, you know, what I have found when someone outreaches to me, the first thing that they look at is my face, because I'm an African-American woman, and they see someone that looks like them. And I think that's very important for my African-American, my Black clients. I'm just going to use Black. My Black clients, when they contact me, I think that's very important. Number one, it offers them an opportunity that maybe when I sit in front of that clinician, they will have an understanding and I won't have to explain to them some of the other aspects of me that I believe are really important in a therapeutic process. One of the things that I find with the African-American client is that there is a uncomfortable feeling of they have to educate somebody about who they are. So with that being said, I think for the clinician who is sitting before them or the clinician who may be in an area where there is not a lot of diversity, with the clinical representation, and they are going to have an African-American client, I think it's also important that they recognize that maybe I can go and do some independent research. And so I have a couple of books that I would like to recommend for the clinician to maybe help them to understand Black Americans and sexuality. It was actually a book that came out in 2012. And I don't know if you want me to name the book.
Oh, yeah, tell us the book and the authors. Writing it down.
Okay, it's actually called Black Sexualities. And it's Black Sexualities, Probing Powers, passions, practices, and policies. And it Rutgers, it came out from Rutgers University Press. The authors, well, the editors are Juan Battle and Sandra L. Barnes. And I
Now spell Juan's last name.
Battle is B as in boy, A-T-T,
mm-hmm.
and Sandra L. Barnes. B as in boy, A-R-N-E-S.
Yes.
And I think one of the some of the most important aspects to understand in looking at some of the stigma, the socialized stigma as a clinician in working with the client. And I'm going to use one of my clients as an example. I met with them this past weekend, and in working with them, she is from Nigeria, and he is African-American. He was born here in the state on stateside. And she and him are struggling in the area of sexuality based upon the fact of what his expectation that he feels he has as a black man to be I don't want to say just have this sexual prowess of I am strong, I am powerful, I am an individual who must always perform to a certain level to fulfill my partner. And if that level is not fulfilled, based upon that expectation that he has, there's a lot of shame that can happen. And I'm finding when I work with African-American men who are addicts, that expectation of what that sexual proudness is as a result of a lot of ingrained sexual expectation that is historical from slave times. Of being a what we call, for lack of a better word, and I'm not a huge fan of this word, but the mandingo, the breeder, to come out and breed a certain stock so that they can have a certain physical type for the slave fields. It was just something that was viewed as you're going to be this type of performer sexually. And it's also something that is instilled all the way through in a lot of different media areas and a lot of different expectations that are stereotypes that infiltrate on many levels. And so if one does not perform at that level, the shame creeps in. And as we know, shame is a big, big, huge indicator that propels someone's addiction and someone hiding in the shadows. And so as a result of that, that has actually happened to this couple. Rather than being intimate with his partner, who he feels he cannot satisfy, he has creeped into a compulsive behavior in the shadows, you know, with pornography and with compulsive masturbation, to where he is not able to connect with his wife. And so just understanding historically where those particular messages come from can really be helpful in working with the client, because we have to unpack that.
And so I want to ask you, being not meaning to be ignorant, but knowing that I'm naive, you would say this need for sexual proudness and empowerment may be even greater in an African or an African-American man than it would in a Caucasian man?
I wouldn't say greater. I would say probably different.
Okay.
I would say different in the sense of, you know, the proudness may be from a different place for, you know, when I work with my clients whom are Caucasian, white men, the power is, it lays more in an area of status. It lays more in an area of money and power in position and in job. And for them, it doesn't necessarily, I haven't found in my experience, it doesn't necessarily come from a historical sense that they have to perform a certain way to satisfy their spouse. Now, that might be different in a different situations. Now, I have had couples where they don't feel like they can satisfy their wife because of size or et cetera. However, that historical piece that's on with the African-American man and where that comes from, it's slavery, is a different ingrained piece than on the other side that I found with Caucasian men.
Yes, so, that does make sense. And so reading Black Sexuality by Battle and Barnes will help sensitize us to the differences between African-American or Black or African men and other races or cultures, correct?
Yes, I believe that that is a book that will help understand some of the sexual history and the politics that plays into it. There's also another book called Intimate Matters, which actually talks specifically about race and sexuality as it relates to America. And it was actually published in 1988. And within that book, they actually look at the themes not only of the sexuality of Black men, they also look at the sexuality of Black women, which is something which is truly a passionate area of mine. I have some groups that are going right now, and it's actually taking a look. We are taking a look and working with the women in that group about how sexually they feel that is the main way that they connect to partners, and they feel that that's really all they have to offer to their partners is their sexuality. Now, this is one thing that I found across the board with white women, the Hispanic women that I have worked with, some Asian women, is that sexual and desired piece that is so important that has them connecting with many, many partners when they really want love and intimacy, but they're using sex as a bartering to get the attention that they want. But I find with the African-American women, it is a little deeper in the sense of they are getting shamed by the same men that they're going to that are having relations with, you know, that are having sex with them. They are shamed, you know, by them after the act, by calling them whore. And can I say that on,
and
on the air?
You
they are, you know, they're calling them whore and slut. And, you know, you seduced me, you tempted me, you knew exactly what you wanted from me. So it's reinforced from them, from the exact same men that they're seeking their love from, because as Black women, they have been, I mean, you look at a lot of the history of the Black woman as the temptress, someone who is fetishized, and that is, you know, the bodies and the way that the body is shaped, that is just something that is a big struggle also with some women that I have coming contact with who do want to get better, who do want to learn how to have relationships, is, you know, divorcing their sexuality from how they are seeking to be intimate with their partners, divorcing the old script
and, will
and
you
then
tell
rebuilding
me
something more healthy.
One more time, the name of that second book is?
Intimate Matters.
Intimate Matters. Okay, I have heard of that book. And again, the author is?
The last name is, I am going to spell it for you, D apostrophe, E as in echo, M-I-L-I-O, Emilio.
Okay.
And then the second author,
okay. You know, that's what we really need. I know that there has been some feelings that, you know, our CC training, you're a CC CSAT, and I'm a CSAT, really hasn't identified the special needs of diverse cultures and races, and you mm-hmm. want to be the change agent so that we all look at things a little bit differently and do our homework.
Yeah,
we can't, I can't be black, but I certainly can read up on what might make my black clients feel more comfortable so that at least they know I care. You know, at least they
yes.
know I'm sensitive to the issues. And, of course, I want to not only be sensitive to the issues, but I want to see it from their perspective. I want to know it from their perspective.
Right, right. And I think one of the things which impresses me with you outreaching to me, Carol, is, you know, you're actually asking for the narrative of someone, or you're asking, you know, tell me how, you know, you're not making assumptions. And I think that is the most important thing that any clinician can do, because I'm not going to go in thinking, oh, I have all the answers for all black folks because I'm black. You know, that's arrogant. But what I will do is I will go in and I will ask their story and ask their experience, and I won't jump to conclusions because I really do want to know. And I think you, Carol, you can do that. I think many of us can do that if we're humble enough. And I think being culturally humble is a very, very important aspect of it. I mean, because we talk about cultural competence. Competence is the, you know, it's that level of intellectual knowledge. But the humility is recognizing that I am not an expert, but my client is the expert on their experience.
I don't know if you know the answer to this, but do you know how many CSATs are African-American, are black, are African? I know we are a global community. It's not just us in the United States.
Yeah, I have asked that question, and no one seems to know the answer.
Okay, got it.
That's
something we need to know. I think that would be a great marketing tool if we could increase more African-American CSATs. Or, you know, I remember I was actually standing in line with Patrick Kearns, and we were getting our food at one of the residential treatment centers that we were staying in when we were being trained. And I said two things to Patrick, which I was very surprised about. I said, Patrick, do you think it matters that I'm not a sex addict in terms of my ability to help sex addicts? Because I'm a belief, my own personal belief is, if I'm a recovered sex addict and a certified sexual addictions therapist, I'm going to be a better clinician. That's my
mm-hmm.
belief, whether it be right or wrong. And he actually said no. I, to this day, feel like I would do a better job if I had both of those. And a lot of our CSAs are in recovery. So, you know, they do have that expertise, that dual role of actively working recovery and helping clients or their partners.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing I asked, being a woman, I said, do you think it matters that I'm a woman working with predominantly male sex addicts? Because I have female sex addicts, but I would say 85% of them are male. And he again said no. Now, I could understand one, because some would feel more comfortable talking to a woman. And then other men, I'm sure, I don't know about being repulsed by it, but would feel more inhibited to do so. What's your belief about that in terms of our sex? And also, I don't know if you're in recovery or not, but clinicians, recovery versus not.
Well, you know, I am in recovery, but I'm in recovery from substances. You know, I have almost 16 years clean, and I'm in a 12-step fellowship, still very active in that 12-step fellowship. However, before I knew what sex addiction was 16 years ago, I was a huge fan of Patrick Kearns. I read actually Sexual Anorexia and Betrayal Bomb. And so, which I told him this story when I was at the module, and I And I let them know, I said, this book actually helped me to understand me, which is the sexual anorexia book. And I've done my own 12-step work, you know, in the area of relationships and love and the role that that played. But I am a firm believer in being an addict in recovery that, no matter if I am an addict in recovery or not, I still believe my colleague next to me who is not an addict in recovery can provide just as competent expertise, can be just as effective as a clinician with someone who is an addict seeking recovery as me. So I am in the same vein as Dr. Carnes in that I feel you do not necessarily have to be in recovery to be an effective clinician. I believe that as addicts, the addicts sitting across from me, they will seek many different reasons to discount. They will seek many different reasons not to invalidate a suggestion. So personally, I don't allow that to become a factor. I don't announce to my clients that I am in recovery. It's not something that I lead with. It is not something that is necessary. Now, because I'm 12-step savvy and I'm with some, I'm with women who are in SLAA within my groups, I have an understanding of the 12 steps. I have an understanding of their language. However, it doesn't make me more effective. It just gives me more of a level of empathy and another layer of understanding language because I am familiar, very familiar with the 12 steps. Now, with me being an African-American woman, does it help to level the playing field and kind of I like what Brené Brown calls it when one is attempting to establish connection. I don't have to force a vulnerable connection with a client. It's kind of something that the stage is set. However, having that stage set doesn't guarantee a good outcome. You know, I believe, Carol, you can get that same stage and have an excellent outcome just as much as I can. But it's just about understanding the history and what you're dealing with and coming into it and how you will have to connect with the client.
Well, that's good to know that that's your feeling on things because it's always nice to hear what other clinicians think. Not that I, you know, doubt Dr. Carnes, but it's always nice to hear somebody who does have some recovery and what her words of wisdom are. And, you know,
now,
at the beginning of the show, you talked about how, I'm not sure how you said it, but you spoke to the fact that 12-step meetings either aren't enough or may need to be different to be culturally aware. So share a little bit about your belief in sex addiction and 12-step meetings for the African-American population.
Oh, I don't think I mentioned that about 12-step meetings and the African-American population. However, I will speak to it. the reason is I've gone to some 12-step meetings within my area to visit the groups. I believe any place that I refer a client, I want to go and visit the group. I want to go and so I can give them directions, so I can say, you know, this is what this meeting hall looks like, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I don't see as much diversity or as much ethnic diversity within the meetings, and I do let my clients know that. Now, I think one of the reasons that I don't see as much diversity is because they're not as many African-American clients within this area who are going to 12-step meetings, which I think can be an issue and a concern. So I do believe with support groups, and going to meetings and having people who understand life experiences and having a sponsor who understands life experiences, I believe that is very important to have a group that is able to meet your needs in that particular area. You know, for some of the women that SLAA meetings are tend to be for, from what many of the ladies tell me, are a little more diverse for them when they go. Now, how they define diverse is a lot different. Probably they're more talking about age-wise and single women and et cetera, mothers, et cetera. But I do believe that we do need more people whom are diverse and have more groups that are diverse, so that when I do send a member there, that there are people who look like them, because that is important for some of my clients. Right now, that is a huge need within the Dallas area.
Okay, and for our listening audience that may be confused, because I have done probably, in the last 70 shows, I've probably done about 10 on love addiction. But will you explain the difference between SAA or SA and SLAA?
Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous is for individuals who have relationships, who can use relationships in just as an addicting matter. I love the analogy of saying that someone that they're in a relationship with is their cocaine or is their heroin. And they say sex and love because the feeling of love is just as euphoric and intoxicating for them as the act of sex or as any other substance. And so SLAA is a group for those individuals who are sex and love addicts, not just the compulsive behavior that goes with sex alone. Now, sex addicts is for individuals, it's another 12-step fellowship, and it is for individuals who have compulsive sexual behavior that has gotten to the point to where it's affecting their relationship, and this can be from masturbation, this can be to pornography. It's more of the behavioral aspect of sex. And that's how I differentiate it. Now, I can give you how they have it read on their websites or
yeah, that'd be great.
On their book, but I would have to pull it up on my computer.
If you want to, feel free to. In the meantime, you know, I'm sure people are finding this so interesting. And for our Black or African-American, Hispanic, I mean, when we're talking about races, it's tough to be in the minority. And so there are always going to be differences. How can people get a hold of you? And can you share your website with our listening audience?
Yes, they can get a hold of me. My phone number is 469-708-6387, and that's my work cell phone number. And my website is www.vantagepointdallascounseling.com.
Now, I know you're pulling that up for us so that we can get the verbiage from the website itself. I have a question for you, because probably about 65% of my clients that are sex addicts have had some sort of trauma that they're reenacting with their sexual addiction. And another 35% have developed this sexual addiction either from a compulsive fixation they developed early on. You know, they looked at a magazine or they looked at some internet and they just became curious, and that curiosity became compulsive, and then before they knew it, that habitual behavior got the best of them and started controlling their lives. So, you know, it's about 65-35. Do you find that to be the same in the African-American community? Is there as much trauma reenactment? Is there more trauma reenactment?
Well,
do you see that may be a difference for the clinicians that are listening tonight?
Well, the ladies that I work with, I can definitely speak to them. Because I've worked more with the black female addict than anything. I can tell you, I'm pretty confident. I'm just going through my caseload right now, 100%.
Okay.
100% of the ladies that I have worked with, when they started with masturbating, or discovering their outlet when they were in pain, they were like between 10 and 12 years old. This is the range. And they started as a result of physical abuse. Now, not sexual. These ladies were physically abused. And when I say physically abused, I mean physically, verbally, emotionally, mentally abused. And they used the pornography and the chat rooms and the masturbation. They used it to deal with the anxiety of living in that kind of terroristic setting, you know, that they were within. And so I would definitely say that trauma was 100% across the board was the biggest piece for those women that I work with currently.
Okay.
And for the ladies in my groups that are Caucasian, a lot of theirs was related to trauma, and it was mostly about 85% it was sexual abuse. That's how they discovered. That's how they discovered masturbation. Yeah, I'm going in my head and I'm thinking. Yeah, so I would agree with that.
I just wondered because obviously there are differences. There's differences in family makeup. There's differences in, you know, how we're culturally raised differently. There's differences in the support systems available. So I was curious as to what you thought. Now, do you find that clinicians, specifically CSATs, in obviously the sexual addiction field, do you find them to be judgmental or oppressive? And if so, how can we change that?
I have found the ones that are most vocal are the ones that I have an opportunity to form my opinion of. And so I'm on the listserv, and I'm on, you know, ITAP, and I'm on the SASH listserv. I find that the ones that are most vocal are the ones who have a very strong opinion and very strong language attached to them. And so I do find some of it concerning that there are some that are very conservative in their perspective, some that, and when I say conservative is because not only do I work with African-American community that is heterosexual, I also work with lesbian, gay, bisexual, and trans and gender variant communities that are also African American. So I work a huge, and I've been speaking primarily of my heterosexual clients tonight talking to you. But in working with those particular groups, I do find that there is a misunderstanding and a automatic pathology that's attached to some people's lifestyle choices. And I believe that's if we have someone like you or someone like, you know, some of the other clinicians that I see attempting to offer new information and also to, you know, impart like books and other things to read, I believe that if we deliver it in the proper way, educate in the proper way, by not pointing the finger, but more of, hey, let me impart some new information upon you, that maybe other people will be more open to things that are different, things that are not heteronormative, things that are not, you know, homogenous in the sense of from the majority or from the Caucasian perspective. Because the SDI, from what I've seen in my trainings, I haven't seen them speak of people of color in the trainings. I haven't seen that, and I've asked. I'm going to be going to my third module, and I've asked, where are the people of color in these studies? Where are, you know, our gender variant community? Where are all of these people? And so I think that also we need to present information that these populations are relevant, because we only talk about what is relevant to us.
The fact that you're challenging, you know, this organization and us clinicians on a whole to not do a one-size-fits-all, and that's what I clearly hear you saying. You want us to have some sensitivity that we may not even be aware that we don't have. So as we begin to end the show, I want to know for our listening audience, how does a client know when a therapist is affirming and knowledgeable about their experience?
Ask questions. You know, when I encourage this, and I've had clients do it, you know, when you call into a clinician, before you even call, read their website. You can see on their website they speak to what they find important, because the websites are there not only for other clinicians to refer, but also for the client to know who they are. You know, on my website, on our website, we let clients know that we are affirming by having the pictures that we have are of same-sex couples, or of interracial couples, or of Black people, or of Hispanic people. That lets them know that, hey, we do see these populations as relevant. So the face value is really important. How does that clinician present themselves? After that, when you call that clinician, you can ask them questions, you know, what do you mean when you say that you are affirming? What does affirming mean to you? You know, I was at a training and I was asking, I said, so you say that you are affirming to the gay lesbian community. What does that mean? You know, and no one can even say what that means. You know, when one is affirming, it means that they're knowledgeable and they're aware of these of the political, social, historical factors that impact that particular community, and they're able to articulate, you know, what theory they use and that they infuse into their practice that lets them assess for that, you know. Is it the queer theory? Is it the feminist theory? Is it the critical race theory? You know, and you have every right to know the theoretical perspective of someone that you're seeking treatment from. And also ask them, you know, who do you work with? You know, do you work with African-American people? And they're going to say, yeah, I work with African. I said, well, how do you work with them? You know? It's not, you know, using certain theoretical approaches do not work with all populations. And so not using theoretical, but using therapeutic techniques does not work with all populations. I wouldn't necessarily go in with, cognitive behavioral with someone solely who has a process addiction. You need more than cognitive behavioral. And so I let clients know what I use, how I use, and that I don't, and I take them as an individual and I work with them as the individual to meet their needs. So that is kind of
Ruby, great answer. And so I would encourage all of our listeners to ask questions. Don't fear that. And, you know, you reminded me of an African-American woman who did not feel she was understood by her therapist, and she went to a sex addict, and a recovering sex addict, and she went to a male sex addict of 27 years who just happened to be a counselor. He's actually even been on the show, and she shared disappointment in this therapist, and he said, well, call Carol. So not only did she call me, but she asked those questions directly. You know, she said, are you comfortable working with an African-American woman? Do you have any prejudice that you're aware of? Do you think that there are going to be any biases? And, you know, I had to say to her, you know what? There probably will be, out of my own ignorance, but I need to let you know that I will do my best not to have any of those issues. And I would invite you to come and meet me, and then you tell me if you're comfortable, and you sound assertive. You let me know if I do anything that feels even mildly offensive. And she did. And, you know, let me just tell you, strong, powerful woman who has a voice and knows what she needs and is going to get her needs met. And that's what I hear you encouraging all of our listeners to do.
Yes.
Yes.
I do.
So we have been, you've been wonderful. I so appreciate, you know, the time that you've taken to kind of educate and desensitize us to issues that have been occurring that you've seen. And feel free to contact me at any point if you've got other topics that you want to talk about, because I found this incredibly informative and very helpful.
Well, thank you so much, and I thank you for having me on the show.
Absolutely, and the best of luck to you, and I encourage any of you who have questions about race, about gender, about diversity, to contact Ruby, because she really is an expert in our field. I'm proud to have you as a fellow CC. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right. Well, we have to end. We've gone just a minute long. I again applaud you for being with me every Monday night. You know how I love that. And I'm here to make your lives easier, and I'm definitely here to help you live your best life. So as I end of every show, there will be only one of you at all times. I want you to fearlessly have the courage to be yourself. Next week, we have Tom Praw, who's going to be talking about a new type of therapy called RIM. All right, we'll talk to you next week. Have a good one.